From the KTOO Newsroom, I'm Claire Strempel with a quick look at your local and statewide news. Monday was the anniversary of the Great Alaska Earthquake in 1964 and the deadly tsunamis that followed. Before that day, there was no formal way for the government to warn communities about the potential for tidal waves ahead of time. But in the decades since, scientists have been working to build and refine the tsunami alert system in Alaska. There will be a test of that system on Wednesday. KTOO's Anna Canny has more.
People in coastal Alaska might hear a tsunami warning on Wednesday morning. It's just a test, but the people sending it out are worried that not everyone will know that. That's because the system used to send out tsunami alerts is outdated and overly complicated.
We're operating on a system that is probably closer to where meteorology and weather science was 20, 30 years ago, at least.
That's Dave Snyder with the National Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer. At 10:15 on Wednesday, he'll send a warning signal out to local radio and TV stations. During a real tsunami, warnings would go out on cell phones, too. You'd receive a message on your lock screen with an irritating tone. Snyder says that's not supposed to happen during the test, but it could happen anyway. And that's because of the way automated systems talk to each other. When the warning center puts out an alert, all kinds of non-government entities like social media or weather apps can pick it up and spread it. And sometimes they misinterpret it. That means mobile alerts might not specify that it's just a test.
There could be messages looking like a real problem when it really is just a test message. So we do rely on our third-party private industry and enterprise to make sure that they're making sure that they understand the code that we're using so that they can make sure we're not over-alerting or scaring or harming people through bad messages.
It's also possible that the warnings will reach people outside of the testing zone. That's because tsunami warnings are issued using the same boundaries as weather forecasting. They're generally very large areas, and they're not designed for tsunamis. That's led to imprecise warnings in the past.
One of the results of this will be to see, are there places that are getting this alert that shouldn't? And we may find a couple of those places.
The technology for sending out tsunami warnings is still very much a work in progress. In a report last year, the NOAA Science Advisory Board called for a total overhaul of the U.S. tsunami warning system. But Snyder says that could take decades.
20 years from now, when we've redesigned the alert system, it won't happen. But it's a technology thing, and we're constantly working to refine that.
In the meantime, the Warning Center is hoping to collect feedback from people in tsunami zones following Wednesday's test. People can submit their comments at www.ready.alaska.gov. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
The three candidates for Juneau superintendent answered questions at a public forum last night. Frank Hauser has been superintendent of the Sitka School District since 2021. He highlighted his familiarity with Alaska's school funding system. He said he's felt the effects of flat funding from the state.
I understand how important the increased funding is for the districts. I understand because I've been living it for the last, 18 years as an administrator, but the last 2 years as a sitting superintendent.
When asked about a time he faced opposition for a decision, Hauser spoke about bringing Sitka students back full-time, in-person learning in the fall of 2021. He said he had to balance health and safety concerns with the risk of further learning loss. Carly Simon was the second candidate to be interviewed. She spoke about her time as superintendent of the Alachua County Public Schools, where she defied Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's ban on school mask mandates.
I lost that position because the governor removed one of our board members, put in an appointee, and 14 months after my position started, I was removed with a 3-2 vote of no cause.
She also discussed her experience studying school finance and creating a support guide for LGBTQ+ students. The third candidate, Tom Peck, is a superintendent of Lewiston Public Schools in Montana. He said Lewiston's distance from bigger cities and its tight-knit community make it similar to Juneau.
Your superintendent needs to be visible. You got to be visible. So every school event, every spelling bee, every music concert, Every activity, I'm there.
The school board is interviewing the three candidates at the library today. Board members are set to choose the new superintendent tomorrow. In the 1970s, you could go to Cook Inlet and see thousands of beluga whales. 4 decades later, you'd be lucky to see 7 whales at a time. The population stands at around 280 as of 2018, according to the Marine Mammal Commission. KNBA's Hannah Bissett has more information on this decline and recent efforts to showcase the threats.
Cook Inlet beluga whales are a unique subspecies. Their geographical location and their history with the Dena'ina are two of the many reasons. The Aleutian chain essentially traps them in the Cook Inlet, and as a subspecies, they are unique in the fact they have fewer offspring and live shorter lives compared to others. These whales are also crucial to the Dena'ina, as they were used to be hunted for subsistence. With their decline, it is also the death of a cultural practice that an entire generation has not been able to experience since 2005.
We've lost over 1,000 belugas from this population. That's a huge, significant loss.
That's Mandy McGuire talking about the decline of Cook Inlet beluga whales in the past 4 decades. She works for nonprofits focused on pinpointing why this might be happening to belugas. McGuire says their decline in the past 4 decades can be attributed to several things that can be categorized as point and non-point pollutants. Point source polluters have a permit, and pollution comes from a known source.
That would be things such as wastewater treatment facilities, stormwater drains, seafood discharges.
Non-point source polluters don't have a single point of entrance like point source polluters.
So examples of that would be runoff from roads or on the airport, you know, when it rains or snow melts, that all just kind of runs into the inlet.
When it comes to point source polluters, McGuire's work focuses on pinpointing the mixing zones, gas and oil activity, and more. Mixing zones are essentially approved points of pollution. The State of Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation gives out these permits. A large question that the nonprofits have about mixing zones is about how large they are. As of 2023, there's no way to determine how large the mixing zones are in one place. Instead, someone has to open up these permits individually. McGuire says that in order to get a wider view of the population's dangers, there needs to be a database that shows all of the mixing zones and how large they are. The placements of the mixing zones are determined by the organization requesting the mixing zone. The organization also conducts its presentation of the risk to wildlife and presents it to the DEC, who then conducts its study on the potential mixing zone and its pollution. There are no studies conducted by the DEC that take into account all of the active mixing zones and their collective effect on the Cook Inlet. The general public can get involved by participating in the Alaska Beluga Monitoring Program, where citizens can take a class to survey the whales. That information is used by federal agencies to make policies regarding the Cook Inlet. For KMBA News, I'm Hannah Bissett.
Maternal deaths went up 40% nationwide in 2021. That includes people who die while giving birth or within 6 weeks after. The rate also went up in Alaska, but Alaska has its own way of measuring maternal mortality, so comparisons to national rates can be tricky. But in 2021, 20 mothers died in Alaska. It was the highest number of reported pregnancy-associated deaths in the last decade. Ness Farragan leads the state's maternal child death review. They called the increase a call to arms.
We had a tragic number of maternal deaths, pregnancy-associated deaths during that year.
In Alaska, most of those deaths don't happen during labor. Instead, they happen because of violence afterwards. More than half of maternal deaths in the last 5 years were linked to intimate partner violence. Alaska has some of the highest rates in the nation.
But what I see now is that Alaska's pregnancy-associated rate and those pregnancy-associated deaths due to violence are what we're really looking at because that's where we're losing most maternal life, is in deaths that are from mental health, substance-related deaths, and homicide and violence.
There's another factor that may have influenced the spike in maternal mortality in 2021, the COVID-19 pandemic. During Alaska's Delta wave, state physicians spoke out about how overcrowding and rationed care at hospitals had a devastating effect on the maternity ward. And there was an uptick in violence against women throughout the pandemic years. Alaska Native women are disproportionately represented among maternal deaths. The Alaska Native Birth Workers Community is a volunteer nonprofit that offers birth and postpartum support to address that disparity. Farragan also manages a new program that provides free doula support and culturally competent care to pregnant people.
It's kind of become the latest big thing, cultural doulas and doula support as maternal mortality prevention. And then doula support as violence prevention is even an even newer idea.
The program's aim is to prevent maternal deaths from violence. 2021 was the program's first year, and it has since expanded. Varigan says they can see that it's working. It's mostly sunny today with calm wind and a high temperature near 40 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday is partly sunny. You're listening to KTOO.